Thanks for joining us for another episode of JPHMP Direct Talk, a podcast series that brings you conversations that bridge the gap between public health research and practice. Today we are joined by Dr. Ross Brownson, a leading expert in chronic disease prevention and in the area of applied epidemiology. He is regarded as one of the great intellectual, educational, and practice leaders in the field of evidence-based public health. Dr. Brownson has a joint appointment with Washington University School of Medicine in the Department of Surgery and the Siteman Cancer Center. He also directs the Prevention Research Center, a center that develops innovative approaches to chronic disease prevention through translational research. So Dr. Brownson, your background is in chronic disease prevention and applied epidemiology with an emphasis on translation of research to policy. Can you briefly describe some of the roles you've held, including your role as director of the Prevention Research Center in St. Louis?
Sure, yeah. I'll go back into the time of graduate school up to the present in a short description of that. So I went to graduate school in Colorado at Colorado State University, and then my former department chair then had become a division director with the Missouri State Health Department in Jefferson City, Missouri, and he called me one day and said, I've got an open job for a cancer epidemiologist, and if you'd like to come out, I think it would be a good fit for you. So I sort of took a chance and moved that time to Columbia, Missouri, and worked there with the Missouri State Health Department for 8 years, started in a small office of three people as a cancer epidemiologist, and by the end had a division of chronic disease prevention and health promotion of over 75 people. So we had a lot of growth. It was sort of the glory days of rapid growth of federal funding and state funding in chronic disease prevention and health promotion. In 1994, I headed to St. Louis University to become a department chair there with the School of Public Health and spent 14 years there, then moved to Washington University here in St. Louis in 2008 and have been here ever since and really focused on the work of our Prevention Research Center that is focusing on several different domains. One, building research and capacity in state and local public health agencies, working on work with obesity and built environment research, understand how the community environment influences risk of obesity, and then under the broad heading of implementation science, trying to understand how we more rapidly and efficiently translate scientific evidence into public health practice and policy.
So you may have already answered the second question. What are some of the projects the PRC is working on?
Yeah, we're focused really on trying to improve public health practice, address health disparities in disadvantaged communities, and move science to practice. The PRC has about 15 active projects. We have, you know, really interesting projects going on in state health departments where we're addressing the concept of what we call misimplementation. And what that means is how often health departments are implementing programs that are ineffective that ought to be stopped, or are not implementing effective programs that should be either started or scaled up. So we're working on that project first to get a lay of the land, and then doing a system science approach called agent-based modeling, which will identify sort of modifiable ways that we can reduce what is essentially the waste of resources in state health departments. We're working a lot with local health departments here in Missouri, 12 health departments, where we're trying to build capacity, build leadership, and scale up evidence-based decision-making processes. And then we have a project in rural Missouri that's focusing on sort of a multi-level intervention approach to promoting a physical activity in six rural communities in southeast Missouri. Surprisingly to a lot of people, rural communities, 10,000 people and less, have the very lowest rates of physical activity. So the preconceived notion of a lot of people is that there's a lot of day-to-day physical activity in smaller communities, but that's just not what the data shows. So we're trying to really focus on the disparities that exist in a number of rural communities around the region here in Missouri and Illinois.
So that kind of leads to my next question a bit. What are some of the behavioral, environmental, and other factors that contribute to chronic disease, such as obesity, particularly in these rural communities?
Yeah, I mean, that's a complicated question. There are many factors, many kind of intersecting factors. If you think of things in a multi-level ecologic context, and you have at the top, you have sort of the broad community environment and the policies. And then in the middle, you have organizations where people work or where they worship or where they go as gatherings. That leads to the idea of interpersonal factors, the social support people get, all the way down to the individual. And so there's usually four or five layers of factors across those different levels that influence activity or the lack of activity. So if you think of physical activity as the example, zoning policy influences whether people have sidewalks or how communities are built. The built environment in a community, are there walking trails? Are there sidewalks? Are there a lot of green space where people can walk or bike or spend time in nature? And then the organizations, does the workplace where you work every day, support physical activity in the policies and incentivize that? At the interpersonal level, it might be, do your family and friends do physical activity together? Do you enjoy it? Do you encourage family members and friends to do physical activity? And then the individual can all be all the way from genetics to people's their gender, their race, sort of the individual determinants of physical activity that are influenced by all these other levels. And so it's a complicated set of factors. And what we try to do for effective interventions is intervene at all these levels, but especially at the broader community and policy levels to influence chronic disease risk.
So you'd mentioned that you work a lot with policymakers to help understand how they receive information and to better share evidence-based research that can positively affect public health policy. Can you speak a little about your article, Getting the Word Out, New Approaches for Disseminating Public Health Science, which appears in the March 2019 issue of the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice? What are some of the lessons or best practices for disseminating research?
Yeah, that's a good question. I guess I would start by saying is we ought to try to think and act not like a researcher, but like someone in another field. So a communicator, someone who really knows how to reach various audiences. The piece we did there was sort of giving some background on what leads towards effective communication and dissemination. And that starts with something, there's a model way back out of the 1940s that looks at the source of information, the audience you're trying to reach, the message you're trying to convey, and then the channel, which is how you convey that message. And so for policy audiences, it might be that a researcher looks at the world in a certain way, that we want the members of our state to be more healthy. A policymaker might look at it a different way. They might think that, well, health is okay, but we want to look at ways that are going to save our state money. And so the message there has to be, how do we get a health message out, but how do we layer it and segment it in a way that message is tailored to how a policymaker might view the world. And so that's where we start. And we start by getting to people to think, first of all, about who their audience is, how they receive information, what information resonates with them, what sort of information, if it's a policymaker, is relevant to their constituents, the people that elected them, if it's an elected official, and then going from there. And we often reach out to communications experts or political scientists or others who are not necessarily researchers, but have a good idea about how to reach policymakers. And those are a few of the lessons that we put forth in the little article that you mentioned.
You said before in other interviews that I found when I was doing a little bit of a search on some of your work, that some of the barriers to the uptake of research to practice are lack of incentive, workforce preparedness, and leadership decision-making. You're a co-author of another article in the July issue of the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice, Organizational Supports for Research Evidence Use in State Public Health Agencies. Can you speak a little about this study's objective and its findings?
Yes, I'm certainly glad to do that. This study was one that was a layered-on study from a larger project, and one of our students, Andre, who led the analysis, and it was sort of, so it was about almost 900 workers in state health departments, and Andre did what he calls a latent class analysis, which is an advanced statistical method of taking information, and so the outcome we're looking at is what leads toward use of science and research information in decision making in this case in state health departments. And what the latent class analysis allowed him to do was to group employees into four distinct groups that predicted whether people do or don't use science in their day-to-day work. And I won't go into all the groupings, but what we found out was there were certain critical factors, things we call organizational supports, that really predicted the use of research information in state public health. Those are things like having access to information. That might be having a portal where you can go find the latest information, whether someone's supervisor expects them to use information from research sources in their day-to-day work, and then the broader concept of what we call participatory decision-making, especially on important decisions that are going on in a state health department. Do supervisors, do leaders engage the employees in learning about and making those decisions? And those things look like they're organizational factors. Some people call it the climate and culture of an agency. And not only in this study, but in a number of other studies, they look to be very important toward more quickly moving research to practice in state and local public health agencies.
Okay, let's talk a little about public health accreditation and another article in JPHMP, Public Health Agency Accreditation Among Rural Local Health Departments, Influencers and Barriers. Why are smaller rural health departments less likely than micropolitan health departments to seek accreditation, and why is this important to understand?
Yeah, it's an excellent question. So rural health departments face, in a way, what we call the dual burden in public health. And the dual burden just means that they face some of the highest health risks. In other words, the highest disparities occur in small rural communities. And they also tend to have the challenge of having lower resources. So they're not having hundreds and hundreds of staff. They maybe don't have a school of public health outside their door where they can get intern students, where they can hire people. And so kind of right off the bat, there are some really unique challenges that rural, low density population areas face. The study you mentioned came from the NHO profile survey. So it's a nationwide survey that we're able to stratify by the size of the jurisdiction. And we found that there are some unique barriers and challenges that the smaller rural health departments face that in a way aren't rocket science. That kind of makes sense. There's a fee for accreditation, so the fee can be a challenge and a barrier for a rural health department to overcome. They tend to have smaller staff sizes, and they also tend to be understaffed, and they may not have some of the technical disciplines that are required to fulfill accreditation. And then sort of the entry point of this is that, accreditation is a voluntary process. A health department has to perceive a benefit. And it appeared from this article and others that the perceived benefits of accreditation are lower among some of the rural health departments than they are in more urban and suburban settings. And so it's really important to understand these and begin to think about how accreditation can be tailored, how rural health departments can be supported in the accreditation process so that they can essentially be on an equal playing field with other health departments across the U.S.
What role does the academic health department play in achieving evidence-based public health or public health 3.0?
The emphasis in public health 3.0 is sort of the underpinning that we have more knowledge and tools than ever before, and we're in a position to apply those in new and exciting ways, and that yet we have large inequalities. And so there's a distinct emphasis in Public Health 3.0 on the social determinants of health. And so as we think about this linkage between practice and the academic world, in particular the formal academic health department, I think there's a number of ways that it can connect and further the idea of evidence-based decision making. One is that universities are good at analytic disciplines like epidemiology and finding data, understanding where health risks occur, where disparities occur, what some of the influences are in driving, and what the resulting interventions might be. to address some of the key elements from Public Health 3.0, building better data skills that cross over between health departments. In many ways, health departments have lots of data that are in need of analysis and dissemination. And often universities, whether it's a public health training program in community health or a program in a different discipline, can often help with those data skills. And then I think also a really important part for Public Health 3.0 is having new partners and new disciplines. So not just rounding up the usual suspects of the health sector, but thinking about economists or the agricultural sector or the school sector or the city planning. And I think universities often have departments that focus on those disciplines. And I always argue that really some of the biggest strides we can make in public health are going to come from disciplines outside of public health. And we spend too much time in our own sort of health silos and not enough time in other ones. And I think this idea of building stronger academic practice linkages can really foster new disciplines and new players coming to the table to address these health issues.
So this year marks the 25th anniversary of the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about how long you've been part of the editorial board and what JPHMP has meant to you as it relates to your work.
So that's exciting, 25 years. That should be sort of the silver anniversary. So I hope everyone gets to have some little piece of silver to remember that. I joined, I believe, in 2007. So I've been on the editorial board for about a dozen years and I've known about the journal ever since it started 25 years ago. I've been in public health that long. I think sort of the unique and special part of the journal is, number one, I guess, is that it's really a go-to source for rigorous science, but rigorous science that's relevant to state and local public health practitioners. Looking for topical areas, intervention science, new emerging health issues that are relevant, timely, and actionable for public health practice. And I think that's probably the biggest thing. The journal has been, for my work, for the work of my teams, has been an ideal venue for a lot of our work. As we've talked about other times, our work is trying to improve public health practice. And that's essentially what the journal is trying to do as well. And I think the other thing the journal has done that's a little different than a lot of other journals is they've done some really timely and unique theme issues that are showcasing hot topics, emerging areas, showcasing collaborative work between practitioners and academics and people working in non-governmental organizations that I think is a little different than a lot of journals and really tends to highlight things that are especially relevant to those out working in day-to-day public health.
Well, is there anything else you'd like to add that I haven't asked already?
I guess there's a couple things I was thinking about. One, I think we still don't have as much activity in the journal of publishing from practitioners. So I think if I was going to add something, it would be for us to find ways to better engage practitioners in publishing their work. For the people working in the ivory towers of academia, the publication is kind of the coin of the realm. It's necessary for people to advance in their careers. And that's not really the case for people out working in practice. So I think we're finding ways to link practice and academic, as we've talked about, that are a good example of that, the academic health department, I think, will move us forward. I know the journal is moving more and more on open access on a number of the articles. And I think the open access movement is a really exciting movement for the future, because we find one of the biggest reasons why practitioners don't read journals like the Journal of Public Health Management Practice is they don't have access to a library where they can get the journal articles. I think that is an important thing for us to focus on going forward. And then I think also just kind of focusing on a number of the emerging topics that the journal's been focusing on, like climate change or how technology can be a bigger part of public health practice and intervention, and then how we address the growing inequalities in the U.S. and other parts of the world. I think those are all important and exciting things as we move forward and look forward to the next 25 years.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Brownson, for taking time to talk with me today. I really appreciate it.
You're welcome. Thanks for thinking of me. I hope something there was helpful.
This feature was brought to you by JPHMP Direct, the companion site of the Journal of Public Health Management and Practice. To learn more about the research presented in this conversation, visit us online at journals.lww.com/JPHMP.